This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Kelly Anissa. In its election manifesto, Pakatan Harapan stated that they will provide registered refugees in Malaysia the legal right to work. So on today's show, we discuss the latest report from Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs, or better known as IDEAS, about the economic impact of granting refugees in Malaysia the right to work. Joining me on the show today is Lawrence Todd, the Director of Research at IDEAS and also the author of the paper. Welcome to the show, Lawrence.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You know, let's just start off with how many refugees does Malaysia currently host?
Well, in terms of officially registered refugees with the UNHCR, there's 160,000 what we call persons of concern. So that includes both refugees mm-hmm. and asylum seekers. Now, asylum seekers are those who sort of are in train to become refugees in the sense that they are fleeing persecution, but they haven't yet been granted that status. So of that total number of 160,000 in Malaysia currently, there's 100,000 refugees and about 60,000 asylum seekers. Now, the total number, including the unregistered, might be higher than this, mm-hmm. But the official registered refugees is 100,000 and then an additional 60,000 asylum seekers.
Right. And, you know, why do you think they've chosen Malaysia?
Well, Malaysia is a country, I would say, of, you know, relative political stability and economic prosperity in the region. If you look back over the last sort of 50 or 60 years, you've seen successive waves of refugee movements into Malaysia mm-hmm. from different sources of conflict and persecution. After the Vietnam War, the end of the Vietnam War in the 1970s, there was a migration of refugees from Vietnam. There were also refugees fleeing the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. Mm-hmm. Southern Philippines as well has been a source of refugees coming mainly into East Malaysia. And then, of course, we've had the Rohingya coming from Myanmar, which has naturally spiked in the last couple of years with the increase of persecution there. And so I think, you know, Malaysia is sort of relatively centrally located within the region and, you know, accessible by a dangerous journey, but accessible by boat. And as I say, is seen as having, relative political stability and security mm-hmm. for the refugees who have, you know, fled very difficult situations in their home countries.
And as mentioned in the report, the official position of the Malaysian government is to categorise UNHCR registered refugees and asylum seekers as illegal or as undocumented migrants. How does that affect their other aspects of life and their overall quality of life in general?
Well, they are, I mean, the integration of refugee populations into Malaysia historically has varied depending on the group. So there have been some refugee populations in the past. You know, I mentioned the Cham refugees from Cambodia that actually have been quite well integrated, mm-hmm. but others have been less so. And I'm afraid the majority of the refugees currently in Malaysia are the Rohingya. And for them, I think they unfortunately live rather on the margins of society.
Right.
So they have some freedom of movement. You know, they're not, you know, restricted to camps, but they are living in their own close-knit communities, mostly in Kuala Lumpur and in Selangor, because they only have access to a very restricted pool of work, and that their access is quite unstable. You know, they can be arrested, they can be detained, their wages can be withheld from them, they can be exploited in any number of ways, and as a result, actually, they don't work as much as the local population. At least that's our interpretation of the data, is that actually the participation rate, which is measures how many people actually are seeking work or in work, is lower among refugees than among the total population, which is what you'd expect, seeing as they don't actually have legal access to work. So anyway, that translates into them having, you know, less money to afford all the basic necessities, whether that's housing or healthcare or education. And of course, that's further compounded by the fact that they have no access to public healthcare or to public education. There is one small caveat to that, which is that the one thing the government does offer is a 50% discount for access to healthcare.
Right.
So they can use the public hospitals and they pay 50% of the non-citizen rates. Which is you know, of course, an important, helpful, contribution from the government. And certainly I wouldn't want to discourage the government from taking that kind of approach. But the reality is that those non-citizen rates are quite high and have increased a lot in the last couple of years as the government has moved to try to, reclaim the full cost of treatment from non-citizens. And mostly that's really targeted at foreigners, expats maybe. And so, you're talking about thousands of ringgits for some treatments. So in practice, although they have this discount, that, the refugees still struggle to access that healthcare because they've still got to find the money for the other 50% and they can't work legally. So what are we sort of expecting them to do? And the reality is they're scratching a living where they can, working in these dangerous jobs. It's, one last point I would make is that, there is a significant network of NGO, civil society and community-based groups working in partnership with the UNHCR to provide some of these basic services like health and education. Indeed, we have, in our partnership with the Ideas Academy, which is a school for refugees here in Kuala Lumpur. So, but that's one of many civil society organizations that provide access on a charitable basis. But of course, that doesn't match up to, what the local population would receive in terms of their access to public education and public healthcare system.
And through these NGOs and these charities, do they also provide financial assistance or support them financially in any way for those who are unable to work?
No, there's no sort of like cash subsidy scheme, or at least not that I'm aware of. It may be that there is, of course, different channels of international aid, but ultimately, what civil society and non-government organizations can provide is going to be insufficient to fully support this larger group of people. As I said, at the beginning, we're talking about, 160,000 people. And so they are left with no choice, really, but to seek some form of income however they can. And because, as we're discussing, because that is only possible if they're prepared to take illegal work, then that restricts them to these dangerous and these dangerous jobs where they're subject to exploitation.
And Pakatan Harapan did pledge in their manifesto to legitimize, to give them the legal right to work to all registered refugees in Malaysia. So it is coming up to 1 year since the election. Have we seen any updates on this front?
Well, that's a very good question. I think that so the previous government had initiated work pilot schemes. So rather than provide refugees with the blanket right to work, they tried this pilot where they placed refugees with specific employers. So that was run in the plantations and in the manufacturing sector. And there were some issues. So on the plantation side, I think it was difficult because, these are not jobs that the Rohingya had been employed in before. So, why would they particularly be suited to it now? And it pulled apart, put some pressure on communities because those refugees participating in the scheme had to be relocated. But at the same time, that was a sort of some effort by the previous government that's been continued under this government to move towards a situation whereby refugees are working legally. And I understand that the manufacturing pilot is proceeding quite well. Mm. So the government is continuing that effort. I recently heard at an event the Minister for Human Resources commenting that he wanted to develop and expand these pilots. And of course, that would be welcome. But I think for us, it's really crucial that, you know, really, if you look at this purely in an economic sense, then the freedom to choose your work is actually a big determinant of how much you can earn. Because if you're restricted to a certain set of jobs in particular industries or with particular employers, if those don't match your skills, that's going to really limit your productivity. And in turn, that will reduce, you know, limit your earning potential.
Yeah.
So that freedom of, you know, of having just an open-ended right to work, you know, of the kind that we all enjoy, or well, at least you enjoy in Malaysia. I as an expat, I have to kind of negotiate a specific job. But but in theory, you know, the fact that we have freedom to find our own work actually is what increases the earning potential, which actually increases the economic return of giving refugees the right to work in the first place. So to come back to your question, the government is continuing with that, with the work pilot schemes. We have not seen any sort of concrete movement towards implementing their promise 1 year on to deliver a much broader right to work. And, you know, our clear conclusion from this report is that they should move to do that, because the benefits for the refugee community are huge. And actually, there are benefits for the whole economy as well. So, I mean, they're not enormous. We're not, you know, this is a relatively small group of people, but, you know, they're here, and giving them the right to work is better than keeping them in this state of limbo.
So we're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be going into the specific key findings. I'm speaking to Lawrence Todd, the Director of Research at Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs, or better known as IDEAS, about their latest research paper. We'll be right back after the break. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Kelly Anissa. I'm speaking to Lawrence Todd, the Director of Research at Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs, or better known as IDEAS. We are talking about their latest research paper, which is on the economic impact of allowing refugees to work in Malaysia. What kind of research methods were used for this? You know, did you interview refugees and NGOs?
So what we were trying to look at was quite narrowly asked the question of, okay, so we have these 160,000 refugees and asylum seekers, and they don't currently have the legal right to work. In fact, they don't currently have any legal rights at all. So, but, you know, as you mentioned in your introduction, the government has promised in its manifesto to grant those people the right to work. So we said, okay, let's just take this very, very narrowly, looking at the economics of it. What would happen if we gave this group of people the right to work? So yes, we met with NGOs and with the UNHCR, of course, and those that work with refugees. But the core analysis we undertook was looking quite strictly at this economic question. And I mean, just, you know, I won't go into too much detail into the methodology, but what I would say is the core idea of it was that actually many of these refugees are already working,
right. But
they're doing so illegally. They're working in illegal jobs. And the jobs that are available, if you don't have a legal right to work, are highly restricted. You know, you're not going to be able to come and work at BFM or in a sort of respected organization. You're going to be working in dirty, dangerous, illegal work. So what we said was, okay, well, let's assume that if they're given the right to work, what should then happen is that refugees should be able to earn a salary commensurate with their skill level. So if you look at the rest of the population, you know, skill level is really the biggest determinant of your income. But for the refugees, this is not the case, because the biggest determinant of their income is the fact that they are restricted to a narrow pool of dangerous and low-paid work. And then that's further exacerbated by the fact that they might suffer workforce exploitation. So if you take all that away and you give them the freedom to move across all the jobs in Malaysia, where would they end up based on what their skills are? And then let's assume that they earn those wages. And then how does that translate into an economic boost in terms of those refugees then earning more money and therefore being able to spend more money, which means buying goods and services that are produced in Malaysia.
So could you just give us an overview of some of the key findings in this paper?
Of course. So the headline conclusion is that granting refugees currently in Malaysia the right to work would be would have a positive impact on the economy and on the public finances. What that translates to is an increase in GDP of about 3 billion ringgits by 2024 on the assumption that we move ahead with the right to work this year. So within 5 years, you see that contribution growing to 3 billion. And then over that same period, we would expect to see an increase in the contribution to public finances. So in terms of tax receipts, so this includes both income tax paid by refugees on the basis that they're not really currently paying anything, and also the indirect tax. So that's, you know, really amounts to the SST paid on goods and services consumed. So that contribution would be about 50 million ringgits by 2024. So these are not, I would say, enormous numbers, but they are significant. You know, they are kind of meaningful, positive contributions. And then I think the other important area to discuss is what's the impact on the wider labour market? You know, what happens to other Malaysians? Because I know this is an issue that people are concerned about, you know, the competition for work and how refugees would play into that. Now, so because of the profile of refugees in terms of their skill levels, they are significantly less skilled on average than the local Malaysian population.
Okay.
So what we find, and this is using some findings from the World Bank back in 2015, was that these lower skilled workers tend to complement Malaysian workers rather than substitute for them. So what that means is that they help better educated Malaysians earn more and create more jobs among that group. So actually, in total, we would expect the net impact, again, by 2024, was that refugees would have helped to create 4,000 jobs, which, again, not a huge number, but it's a positive number. And there might that might mask some negative impact in terms of, you know, a slight reduction in wages for some groups and perhaps some a few lost jobs. Those negative impacts would be mostly concentrated among other foreign workers. So if refugees are given the right to work, they're most likely to compete with other foreign workers, not with Malaysians. If they do compete with Malaysians, it's likely to be older, less educated Malaysians rather than younger or better educated. So that's generally the complexion of the impact. But as I say, the net impact overall is positive. So even those what I would say is minor negative impacts are significantly smaller overall than the positive potential impact.
And speaking about them working here, so some of us have heard about how refugees or migrants are employed because they cost less. So if they has that been taken into consideration in the report about what their salary would be like? Does it take into consideration that they will be paid equally to a local who is doing the same job with the same set of skills?
Yeah, it's a good question, actually. So the answer is we do actually take that into account. So even though once they're given the right to work, refugees should in theory be able to earn the same, you know, as Malaysians for the same work. Actually, the reality is in Malaysia that foreigners tend to be paid less for the same job if it's low and medium skilled. So if it's like being a labourer working on a construction site or if it's administrative clerical work, foreigners actually tend to get paid more than Malaysians for the most high-skilled jobs, so for managerial and highly professional jobs, so which is quite an interesting fact that we could discuss, I'm sure.
Right.
But with these refugees, I mean, I think probably 90%+ would be in low and medium-skilled jobs, and therefore would get paid less for the same work than locals. So we account for that. You know, we estimate that total pay discount is about 17%. So our analysis assumes that a refugee working on a construction site will still earn less than a Malaysian doing the same job, because that's what the evidence suggests. But that refugee will still earn more if it's working legally than if it's working illegally.
Right.
He or she is working illegally.
And you mentioned earlier about how this would create job opportunities. And in the report, these job opportunities would extend to locals even. Mm. So I'm sure some people would be wondering, how would that work? You know, how would allowing refugees to legally work create more job opportunities for locals?
Well, the way it works is that you have to consider how refugees would contribute to the economy more widely. So let's imagine we have, you know, a group of refugees that are currently, you know, only able to spend, you know, a 50 ringgits a month on, you know, on entertainment, let's say. Now, if they're given the right to work and their incomes increase to 300, 400, 500% even, then that increases to a disposable income for entertainment to, you know, 500 plus ringgits. Mm. Now, where is that money going to get spent? That money is going to get spent in shops run by Malaysians. So that additional demand that's created in the economy will stimulate economic opportunity in the economy more widely. So if you're running a shop that's selling things that refugees want to buy, then you're going to do pretty well out of refugees being given the right to work, and maybe you'll hire somebody. Maybe you'll create a new job opening to manage that greater business. Mm. So when we say that there's positive impacts for locals, it's about zooming out a bit and saying, okay, there might be some very localized competition. That's true, but actually the net effect is definitely positive, because it's like adding this stimulus to the what we call the demand side of the economy. So the refugees want to spend their money, and they're going to spend it here, and they're going to spend it on things that Malaysians are making and selling.
How does the cost of refugees impact public finances here in Malaysia?
Well, essentially refugees have no entitlements to any real public services. Mm-hmm. So they don't receive any welfare. They don't have access to the education system. There's this important point on the healthcare where they do receive a discount, which is effectively a subsidy, but they obviously have to match the amount. So we don't have statistics on exactly how much that's used, but 50% of refugees were unable to access the healthcare they needed because they couldn't afford it. So we know that already half of the refugees are not really using that discount, because for them to provide the other 50% is too expensive. So that takes care of the sort of, so on the public service side, there are costs associated with the detention and arrest of refugees. They are, as you mentioned in one of your questions, they are treated as undocumented workers. And, you know, we've all seen, outside the LRT station, people being stopped and asked for their cards and their passports. And refugees can get caught up in that, and they can get detained, and that can cost, you know, 50 to 70 ringgit a day. Mm-hmm. Obviously, refugees are a much smaller proportion of the overall undocumented worker population that, as a whole, you know, are quite a significant cost in terms of arrest and detention. Now, that's one of the costs that would immediately fall away if you gave refugees the right to work. Another potential cost, and I wouldn't want to make any specific claim about the refugees because we haven't looked at this issue enough, is that, coming back to healthcare, is that if you poor health in that refugee community could potentially have a wider impact on public health. In some other refugee communities around the world, you know, where they haven't been given proper healthcare, you know, infectious diseases can develop and spread, and that can have a wider impact on public health, which then has to be dealt with in the public health system. So that can in turn indirectly create a cost. And again, that's something that can actually be addressed by ensuring that refugees have some access to healthcare, or at least have the means to earn the money to buy their own healthcare. Mm. And then finally, you know, there's obviously an argument that refugees, through being here, will have some wear and tear on infrastructure, you know, using the roads and so on. But it's very difficult to assess how much that costs. I would say overall that refugees probably at the moment, it's very difficult to be exact about it, but, you know, I think it's reasonable to claim that they are currently a net cost in terms of the public finances. But I think if given the right to work, where their incomes would increase and therefore their spending would increase and then therefore their tax contributions would increase and those that earned more would pay direct income tax, then that would definitely move that in the other direction and they would be net contributors. And then if you go even further and you encourage them to participate in the education system, perhaps even bringing them into the public education system, Then their contribution would grow very significantly and eventually you'd see that population contributing hundreds of millions in tax. Mm. So actually, it would be a net positive decision in terms of impact on the public finances to give them the right to work. That's only going to mean they contribute more, certainly not less. So, which is another reason to do it.
And, besides some of the legal obstacles that, we discussed, like, for example, not having the legal right to work, what sort of challenges do you think stand in the way of, these work opportunities? Do you think local companies would be open to it? Are they, especially if they have to pay them perhaps a higher salary compared to what they're used to? So do you anticipate any support or backlash for this?
Well, there may be some employers who are currently employing refugees illegally and benefiting from being able to pay them lower wages. So I wouldn't have too much sympathy for them complaining about this. But in general, I think employers would be very supportive. There was a delegation of multinational employers actually in town last week advocating for Malaysia to adopt this right to work because they actually want to give these refugees opportunities. That delegation included the former Deputy Prime Minister of Turkey, who was talking about the Turkish experience of giving 4 million refugees the right to work. Puts up the Malaysian issue in perspective. And they'd created 6,000 businesses, 40,000 jobs. So I think employers in general would be very keen. But I think that the other challenge is, how do you build the support among the local population to do this? As I mentioned earlier, the treatment of different refugee populations historically in Malaysia has been dictated largely by these kind of cultural questions, like how easily it is for these communities to assimilate. And I think that's actually where we need to focus on building support, is that people want to help these refugees and see them as a contributors, not a burden, and that there's some political will to embrace them into Malaysian culture and not have them existing in the margins of society. So I think that's more where the challenge is, not so much amongst the employers.
And speaking about being welcoming towards refugees, in 2018, Eric Paulson, who is the legal director of the rights organisation, Fortify Rights, was quoted in a Free Malaysia Today article saying that people are being conditioned to fear foreigners, and so much so that they feel that it is okay to discriminate against them. And he also mentioned that politicians and the media were guilty of sending out messages of a us versus them complex, with citizens against foreigners. So only putting foreigners in a bad light or, just downplaying their contributions altogether. And that was before we had a new government. So do you see any improvement today with the new Pakatan government and even in the media in terms of how we treat people who are, say, non-locals?
I think firstly, it's very important to not allow the discussion about refugees to become a discussion much more broadly about foreign workers in Malaysia. In fact, I think this is a big challenge that we often come across, is that immediately the discussion widens and we're talking about, a conversation that's really about, 100,000 people that have escaped really terrible persecution, have sought Malaysia as a place of refuge, have been accepted here as people who, need safety. And then it's just a question of whether they should also be given the right to work because they're here anyway. that discussion should not be mixed up in this much broader discussion around the, 6 million potentially foreign workers that are here and that themselves are made up of loads of different populations that are here for different reasons, that are making different types of contribution, that face different challenges, and so on. So I think that's the main point I would make, is that I think we have to kind of treat the refugee question on its own terms and not let it become a broader question, because otherwise that's where we really get stuck. First of all, we should look at it from a humanitarian perspective and say that, you know, we want to provide refuge to these people. And then, given that they're here, why not let them work so that they will be vastly better off themselves and actually make us all a bit better off too?
So that question was actually in relation to the fact that that xenophobia does exist among certain communities. And, you know, just taking that into context here, for example, where, you know, some individuals might, happen to feel that same way towards refugees, regardless of the humanitarian perspective. So what can be done for individuals like that to overlook that distrust towards a group of people who are foreign to us, which to some might include refugees, unfortunately? How can they welcome the findings in your paper without that kind of pushback?
Well, in my experience, the best way to diffuse distrust between communities is usually just getting to know each other. I think I've seen in multiple occasions that, you know, once the barriers between communities are broken down and there's space for interaction and knowledge, that relations almost, 100% of the time will improve. So I think, coming back to some of the things we were discussing earlier, the fact that the current legal status of refugees isolates them, keeps them on the margins of society, puts them in a position of, to be honest, relative deprivation and therefore desperation, encourages this perception that they're different. Mm-hmm. Whereas if they are, working alongside us day to day, if they're in a position to improve their lot in life, increase their incomes, and thereby, essentially integrate in multiple ways, going to the same shops as everyone else, doing the same things, going to the cinema, buying a car, eventually, hopefully, saving up enough to buy a flat, whatever it is, rather than ghettoize them and allow them to live on the margins of society, I think, that would be the best way of breaking down some of those barriers that you allude to and some of those challenges around perception. I also think that, and this is something we talk about in the report when we think about the longer term considerations here, is that access for refugees into the education system in Malaysia would be very, very powerful, certainly in terms of improving the potential economic contribution that refugees could make. Mm. But I also suspect would have a big impact in terms of breaking down some of those negative perceptions and encouraging integration. So, I mean, that was not the focus of our report. As I said at the beginning, we were quite narrowly focused on this economic dimension. But right. But I think, allowing these communities to interact and witness each other together, whether that's in the working world, in education, is the way to break down those perceptions. And just the last point, I think that ultimately, of course, getting there's a question of political leadership and political will. And Pakatan Harapan were brave enough to put this promise in their manifesto. And now it's a question of whether they have the political will and the bravery to see it through. And I think that I think they should try and make that case and rediscover that energy and that spirit of openness. And then if they do that, then I think the benefits will be there and will materialize and will speak for themselves. And then that will, even if there is some concern initially, that will be diffused when as the benefits are realized and as greater interaction between communities breaks down those negative perceptions.
Which country should we look at to emulate in terms of, having a successful system when it comes to integrating refugees back into society, and with, just overall good quality of life, having the legal right to work and even better access to healthcare?
Mm. Well, I mentioned the Turkish example earlier. We had, as I said, the Deputy Prime Minister of Turkey was here in a delegation that met with ministers last week. And, you know, they have had an incredible situation facing them, you know, mainly due to the conflict in Syria and the instability in the Middle East more generally. But, you know, I think I referred earlier to the figure of 4 million refugees that have been accepted into Turkey and given the right to work and have become net contributors to the Turkish economy. So I think that provides a kind of really great example. There are other examples. I mean, in my own case, the UK has, you know, accepted refugee populations at various times and has integrated them through, again, through starting with this principle of economic contribution and then extending that to education, healthcare, and public services. So I think that there are lots of these examples. The United States is another where you've got refugees that were accepted into the US and given the right to work now running companies that employ thousands of people and contribute millions to the US economy. I think Malaysia can move in stages. So I'm not proposing that, you know, refugees should be, you know, overnight given all the entitlements of local Malaysians. I don't think that's realistic. But I think there's a clear case for taking this first step of granting the right to work, because you're legalizing something that's already happening on the ground. So there's no point denying it. And actually, if you legalize it, the benefits increase to the refugees themselves and to the wider population. So in that sense, it strikes me as a bit of a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. And I believe that the challenges with it can be addressed with a bit of political will and bravery. And then at that point, we can then look to some of these other examples around the world about, okay, where do we go next? Do we want to look at improving access to education? How do we improve access to healthcare? And so on, looking at the Turkish example, the European, the US.
Mm. And so we're running out of time, but do you have a final message on the matter?
Well, I would say, you know, I think that it was brave to include this promise in the manifesto. And I hope that the government, I hope the government reads the report.
Yeah.
And I hope they come back to that promise and they rediscover the spirit that encouraged them to put it in there in the first place. And they take the brave course, which is to provide these people that have escaped a desperate situation with a better life here and to give us all a bit of a boost along the way. I would say to Malaysians that, firstly, that, you know, as I said, these refugees have escaped a desperate situation. But the way to move forward is not to see refugees as a burden, but as a contribution, and to make the most of it. I mean, and to take a bit of a risk and have a spirit of openness. But I think that if we do that, then the returns will be there in terms of, yes, better incomes for the refugees themselves, but that will turn into more job opportunities and higher incomes for Malaysians more generally.
Well, thank you for joining us on the show today, Lawrence. I've been speaking to Lawrence Todd, the Director of Research at Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs, or better known as IDEAS. We were talking about their latest paper on the economic impact of allowing refugees to work in Malaysia. So if you've missed any part of this interview or any Live and Learn segments, you can download the podcast on the BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.